So as you can see, I'll be speaking, my topic is selective ignorability assumptions and causal inference. To begin, methods for causal inference typically are based on assumptions of strongly ignorable treatment assignment or no unmeasured confounders or some variants of those sorts of assumptions. So it's often, maybe even usually, the case that the assumptions aren't really truly believed. They're made casually and to justify the use of standard or desired methods. So what I'm going to try to do here is to propose a variant of this, maybe a more inclusive family, which will of assumptions. And we'll consider how you can do inference under those assumptions. And the context will, as in many of the talks here, being the estimation of the joint effects of sequential treatments or sequential treatment regimes. I'll be speaking to some extent based on a motivating example, which is a study of the effect of erythropoietin in hemodialysis. So I'll speak a little bit about that and what some of the problems in the data set that we had there were. And we'll formulate selective sequential ignorability assumptions. We'll discuss the relation of those to standard assumptions and also at some point to assumptions that can be that are used in instrumental variables. For inference, we'll first consider G estimation. We had a lot of trouble actually getting G estimation to work in structural nested failure time models, which is what we were trying to do in the data. So we'll also consider some sort of, you know, basically likelihood-based approaches as well. And after that, there'll be a little bit of discussion about the role of assumptions of this sort for dealing with missing data and measurement error, and criteria for evaluating whether those approaches are appropriate or not. This is work in progress. You'll see some of the parts where what I've written is written down as more of a conjecture, and if anybody has any eggs to throw or hopefully constructive suggestions, I'd appreciate it. Okay, so a little bit about background from the practical problem, anemia and hemodialysis. End-stage renal disease is a state where your native kidneys are barely functioning, and there are toxins remaining in the blood. It's sometimes called uremia, and you require some sort of renal replacement therapy, which can be either a transplant or dialysis. And the most common type of dialysis is hemodialysis, where blood is removed from the body and is filtered and is returned to the body. People who are being treated with hemodialysis are typically anemic, which means they have reduced red blood counts and reduced hematocrits and hemoglobin levels. The anemia seems to be a result of a combination both of the effects of the end-stage renal disease itself and also of the hemodialysis process, where red blood cells can be destroyed mechanically when they're removed and put and being passing through the machine and being put back into the body. So there are various treatments for anemia in both dialysis and more generally. One of those is erythropoietin, which is a drug which stimulates red blood cell production. Other things which are used include intravenous iron and transfusion. EPO itself is a drug which increases the hematocrit. It's clear that it makes some anemic patients feel better. Concerns have been raised about its safety, and these concerns have been raised based on observational studies and on randomized trials. So there's a concern in evaluating the safety of erythropoietin. So in a project we were working on, we were essentially given data from the U.S. Renal Data System, which is a large database based on claims, which includes essentially all people who have end-stage renal disease in the United States. Not exactly, but close. This has to do with the fact that in the United States, hemodialysis is largely paid for through Medicare. So Medicare collects these data. The database has a lot of problems with it. One of those is that the measurement of hematocrit is incomplete. Hematocrit is probably the key confounder in these data. The problem with it, with the incomplete measure, is this is a claims database. So hematocrit enters the database not to help us control, because we want to control confounding, but because it enters the database because it's recorded to justify a claim for EPO. And therefore, if there's no EPO, typically if people have high hematocrits, and therefore it's been thought that EPO is contraindicated, it's not going to be recorded. Additionally, measurement of erythropoietin is often poor. In particular, it looks like the system does a reasonable job of capturing EPO use when a patient is not in the hospital. When they are in the hospital, there's very little recorded, but we don't really believe that they're necessarily taking practically none. And this is a sick population in which a non-trivial proportion of the time people are spending in the hospital. We'll discuss some of the consequences for this and some solutions below. So the clinical scientific questions have to do with the effect of treatment or erythropoietin given over an extended period. In principle, we're interested in the effect of a dynamic treatment regime, which has been discussed a bunch before here. The idea here is that EPO dose is generally in practice and should be responsive to a person's clinical state. In other words, you wouldn't give the same dose of EPO to somebody who has a hematocrit of 45, which is normal, in the normal range for, for a healthy person, as to somebody who is severely anemic with a hematocrit of 20. One could use several approaches for estimation. We've heard about a bunch of them already. G computation, structural nested models, which is what, along with G estimation, which is what I'll be concentrating on. Marginal structural models. All of these, as originally presented, require some version of non-measured confounders or sequential ignorability. Judea Pearl, in a recent manuscript, likes the term sequential or deconfoundability, which I kind of like. I don't know whether anybody likes it or doesn't like it, but I'll use it sometimes for the rest of the talk. So we'll use some of the same notation for variables as has been used previously here. A will be the observables, over bars will denote history, L will be covariates at a particular point in time. The outcome will be Y, and I'll use underline for a vector of all potential outcomes at a particular point in time. So ignorability, non-measured confounders, assumptions. A version isn't completely precise, but it's analogous to strong ignorability as proposed in Rosenbaum and Rubin, is that all potential outcomes are independent of your treatment assignment at a particular point in time. And now we're doing this at any particular point in time given your whole past history. And this assumption identifies non-parametrically the distribution of the outcomes under all feasible regimes. I'm not also, I haven't put the positivity part of the assumption in here. A different version, which is closer to what's typically used for G estimation, is just a baseline potential outcome, Y0, is conditionally independent of your treatment given the past. That's what's, some variant of that is used to identify parameters in structural nested models, and which in a sense can be viewed as generalizations of effective treatments on the treated. So problems with, I'll discuss a little bit about problems with the usual assumptions as they relate to our, mostly as they relate to this particular data set. One has to do with missing confounder information. Another one is mismeasured confounder or treatment information. Failure to identify confounders as well, and then latent failure affecting treatment. We'll discuss in the context of our problem. And the selective nature of the problems will be discussed. So first, I just want to discuss a little bit about hematocrit as a confounding variable. It's an indication for subsequent EPO. It's associated with subsequent outcomes, not necessarily as a cause. In other words, higher hematocrit is clearly associated with better outcomes, but not necessarily because higher hematocrit levels in this population lead to better outcomes. And it's affected by prior EPO. And as a result of these characteristics, it's a confounder affected by treatment, and standard methods are problematic for estimating the joint effects of EPO levels received at different times. In the graph over here, which is a simplified version, obviously it's sort of an oversimplification, both LM and AM minus 1 are jointly a sufficient set of confounders, and they block all the backdoor paths from AM to Y. And in this example, there's no confounding of the effect of initial EPO, although that could be built into the graph and the model as well. So we're able to control for confounding in this graph using any of the methods that were mentioned previously. So we're going to add in here now what happens if there's missing confounder information. So the graph in the upper right is the graph we had before where hematocrit's measured. If hematocrit's not measured, then I've sort of made LM light to indicate that it's not measured. And then we have a confounding arc here. And the probability of missingness, So we have a confounding arc there, and we can't control for confounding using confounding of the effect of AM now, using observed variables. It's worth mentioning that here the probability of missingness depends on hematocrit. So the missingness itself is ignorable, so the standard methods for sort of filling in the hematocrit levels are presumably not a good idea here. What?
You said ignorable.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, not ignorable. So standard methods for filling in the missing data are presumably not a particularly good idea to apply here. So in any case, so we have ignorability or deconfoundability doesn't hold for the subset of the data in which hematocrit isn't measured. So a different example is prior EPO dose is a confounder of the effect of current EPO, and we discussed previously that it was measured poorly when a subject's in the hospital. So what we have measured is some surrogate in those months, is some surrogate for the true dose of EPO in those months. But the true dose here hasn't been measured. But the surrogate doesn't block this backdoor path from current depot to outcome. So again, our assumptions for ignorability doesn't hold for that subset of the data in which subjects have been hospitalized a substantial part of the month. Other possibilities, I don't have a good example from this data set, would be that the covariate, that's the measured set of covariates are sufficient to control for confounding in one subset, but not another one. In one context, perhaps the one that was being discussed in the last talk, it could be that the variables that were measured are sufficient for controlling for controlling confounding for initiation of treatment, but not for subsequent changes. So another thing, which is what I'm going to present, is sort of a variant of something that Jamie had in a paper that came out last year, is that it's sort of a latent outcome threshold. So that latent potential outcome influences a treatment decision if it's below a particular threshold. So for example, if a latent failure influences treatment, if failure is imminent. So that this could be due to a possibly unmeasured disease state. So that if you're going to get a disease with that would be observed within 1 month if you weren't treated, you might be very unlikely to start to get a high EPO dose. If it were 2 months, it might be a little bit larger. If it were 6 months, it might be substantially larger, but any time beyond 6 months, it won't make any, will no longer be further dependent on that latent time. In this example, it seems that subjects who are about to die are often withdrawn from EPO. That may represent, to some extent, what's going on in these data. So in any case, the way that we can formalize these assumptions is that ignorability or deconfoundability is plausible for an identifiable subject of the treatment assignment times. So formally, we're going to make the same conditional independence assumptions, but we're going to make it conditional on some function here of the covariate history, the treatment history, and this actually should have, instead of AM minus 1, it should be AM, and possibly of the future potential outcomes as well. And if if this function S is a function of the potential outcomes, the subset isn't identifiable, we're going to not discuss that example in much more detail here. And if the function is a function of the future potential, is not a function of the future potential outcomes, the subset is identifiable. So sort of, it's worth briefly discussing a connection with instrumental variables methods. First of all, if you have a randomized trial with noncompliance, one will typically believe that the initial treatment was assignment was randomized, and therefore that the effects of treatment assignment at that time are ignorable or deconfoundable, or there are no unmeasured confounders. But we won't believe that necessarily the subsequent assignments are deconfoundable. So we would make this assumption that this function here is equal to 1 for m equals 0, but otherwise it's equal to 0. And similar assumptions are often used in instrumental variables where the instrument is something else. If you're doing typical instrumental variables, I think, and the econometricians may want to correct me about this, typically they'll sort of assume the second graph for all subjects here. Whereas what we're going to try to do is, in this simplified example, is to assume the first graph where for some subjects where we think that it holds, and the second graph where the information is missing.
Just one quick question, I'm not an economist, but wouldn't, I mean, the IV model would typically not have an IV minus one to Y, wouldn't it?
That's true. So the idea here is that we'd like to try to use the structure of the problem to tailor the assumptions a little bit more individually. Now, another idea here is just in instrumental variables approaches, one typically doesn't want to try to make assumptions about the magnitude of a bias arising from confounding or endogeneity. So here also, the idea of this approach will be that we want to make judgments about conditional independence because we think those are easy, and we don't want to do a sensitivity analysis because those judgments are difficult to do. And some people like myself are lazy and don't... So for inference, we're going to propose structural nest to do this using structural nested models. Once we've made these selective assumptions, we've lost nonparametric identification. So we're going to have to propose some sort of a model for treatment effect. So first, simple models where you have a continuous outcome. This is one form of a simple model with one parameter. Here's one for a failure time outcome as well, also with one parameter involving only the treatment or the treatment history. These models, for our example and for many or most realistic examples, are too simple. For our example, what we would like at the very minimum is a nonlinear dose response. In other words, you wouldn't want to assume that going up to the high, that if going from a zero dose of EPO to a low dose is beneficial, that going from an extremely high dose to an even higher dose is also beneficial. Additionally, we want to allow the effect of EPO to vary with covariates so that the effect of EPO isn't the same for somebody who's severely anemic to somebody who has been overtreated with EPO and whose hematocrit is already too high. So we can propose multi-parameter models. Here are simple three-parameter models which capture the ideas that I mentioned on the last slide. So standard G estimation, you would use your model to get a putative potential outcome. Here for the simple one-parameter model, we have a putative potential outcome at time m, y0m of psi, which we calculate using the formula over here. And heuristically, if the model is rank preserving, then the putative potential outcome that we have is equal to, this should say ym0, the true potential outcome. And for inference, we test a causal theory under deconfoundability by testing conditional independence of the treatment at time m and some of the future potential outcomes at that point in time, given the past measured history. And then we invert the test to obtain point and interval estimates. So with selective deconfoundability, we'll test the causal theory under the selective version. So we'll substitute testing the conditional independence, but now only within the subset of person intervals for which S is equal to 1. This can also be formulated in terms of estimating equations. So there's sort of an outline of how, in principle, we wanted to do inference. With problems that we had with G estimation result from, as best as I can tell, from artificial censoring, and which is an approach which is needed to get G estimation to work. In any case, here, end up treating some subjects who failed as being censored. And the amount of censoring depends on what value of psi you propose. And some of the problems that result from this are that functions that are being used for optimization aren't smooth functions of the parameter anymore. In multi-parameter models, the optimization is then difficult. Additionally, I think a different data set is being used for testing each value of psi. And if the model is misspecified, there may be no values of psi which are consistent with the assumptions in the joint distribution of the observable data. So some possible solutions would be some variant of G estimation for discrete failure time outcomes. There's a log link. Jamie and co-authors have a paper about this. But my understanding is that that assumes a relatively rare outcome, which isn't true in this population. There's logit links where you can't be semi-parametric. And Elson, Steinman, Sealand have a paper about doing this in a simple setting. It's not, to the best of my knowledge, been worked out for the sequential treatment problem. So we'd like to try to apply likelihood-based approaches here. To my knowledge, this approach hasn't been tried for inference for structural nested failure time models. Anybody please correct me if that's not correct. You can formulate a likelihood over here for the joint distribution of the observables in terms of the potential outcomes and your causal parameter psi and other parameters. I wrote this. This isn't exactly the right likelihood, but it's is more one for a continuous outcome. But then we'll want to impose our selective ignorability assumptions on this by saying on the likelihood. So some of the remaining issues and problems. First of all, you have to then have some sort of a specification of the model for the non-ignorable treatment. And our inference is potentially sensitive to this, and this is undesirable. And unlike what G estimation does, so we'd like to consider ways to make inference less sensitive. One way might be, rather than just assuming a linear, that treatment is a linear function of the potential outcomes, to have a more complicated function, a more flexible function, so that the modeling assumptions are conveying less information. An additional problem is the models for the covariate process. If the covariate is high dimensional, it's going to be extremely difficult or impossible to specify those models correctly. And this can lead to bias in the estimation of the parameter that we care about. And the estimation will also be computationally intensive. A possible solution to the misspecification issue might be targeted maximum likelihood, which has some double robustness properties. And an additional issue is that we have, with failure time outcomes, to deal with the censored data likelihoods, where we have to, for the censored observations, have to integrate out some stuff. And I haven't attempted this. I imagine that can get pretty hairy. So these are some challenges for trying to implement the ideas with these data. I want to speak a little bit now about issues that are connected with measurement error. And the measurement error problems that I described previously applied both to treatments and covariates. And I want to consider the consequences of this both for testing the null and for testing alternatives. So under the null, we can continue to test ignorability. And over here, and we're doing this now essentially for the subset in which we believe that there's no measurement error for the past, for either the current or the past, for the current treatments or the past treatments. So we have no measurement in the selected subset for the current treatment, for the treatment history, and also no mismeasurement of the potential outcomes, because under the null, the potential outcome is equal to the observed outcome. So there's no consequence of measurement error of either of the either the covariates or of the treatment for calculating our blip down or putative potential outcome. So the test of the null will still be valid in this subset if it was valid before. This gets a little more problematic under alternatives to the null, though. Because what happens now is that we've been okay so far. Is that now measurement error of either L or A can impact the calculation of our putative potential outcomes Y. And if we get that model wrong, we'll be calculating incorrect values for the potential outcomes. So then there's no guarantee of consistent estimation. And again, for reasons that were stated before, we don't really think that the data are missing at random or ignorable, and we can't really use the usual missing data approaches for filling in those values. So it seems to me that in this setting, consistent estimation is too ambitious a goal. I mean, it's something we would like to do. What we would like is methods which have low bias and are relatively insensitive to assumptions about missing data. My conjecture here is that methods based on these selective assumptions are preferable. The idea here would be we can consider different types of estimators, psi hat of j, which would be the jth estimator of psi, and we can classify these estimators on two axes, whether at least one of those is whether they are using some sort of measurement error corrections. In other words, if you're trying to, for a given individual, trying to use some sort of model to, let's say, impute the correct value of L or A. And the second axis would be whether we're using selective deconfoundability assumptions. And it might be worth in this setting considering simple estimating functions where you can get, I haven't worked this out yet, analytic expressions for the bias using sort of simple G estimators. This would especially be likely for continuous outcomes where all the formulas are simpler. How would we decide whether some estimator is good or not? We could consider minimax evaluation of risk of estimators under different missingness mechanisms. This would sort of be a sensitivity analysis approach, or we could conceivably adopt a sort of a Bayesian approach where we have a prior for the missingness mechanisms, and we could look at posterior bias variance mean squared error or some utility, or expected utility under those mechanisms. I don't know whether it's worth considering what would, whether in G estimation it would be worth trying to figure out what would be the optimal estimating function to use and how to get honest confidence statements from this. So a little bit of a discussion now. I've tried to argue that these new assumptions, that this sort of assumption is sometimes more plausible than standard assumptions. And inference here is possible based on a combination of these assumptions. And we also now have to add modeling assumptions here. It's worth just pointing out that the loss of non-parametric identifiability in and of itself shouldn't be terribly bothersome, because in these complex problems we don't have you're going to have to resort to modeling assumptions anyway in even huge data sets like what we're dealing with. However, what it does mean is that there will be reduced ability to test various whether your model specification is correct or not. So we have formal results here for inadequate control of confounding and for measurement error under the null. Obviously, additional work needs to be done for measurement errors under alternatives, and I haven't considered this in the context of the estimation of optimal dynamic treatment regimes. And obviously a lot of additional work needs to be done to be able to get these ideas to work with failure time outcomes and to try that with the USRDS data. And I guess I've ended a little bit early, so there's I'd be glad to entertain questions.
Any questions, then maybe we'll adjourn for lunch and come back at 1:15.